Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the FY24 cycle of the annual report work group. I'm Peter Karras with ASDP/ONC, and I would like to thank you for joining us today. I will be serving as the acting designated federal officer for today's call on behalf of Seth Baczynski. And just a reminder that all work group meetings are open to the public and public feedback is welcomed and encouraged. Members of the public can type comments in the Zoom chat feature throughout the meeting or make verbal comments during the public comment period that is scheduled towards the end of today's agenda. I will now begin the meeting with a roll call of the workgroup members. When I do call your name, please indicate that you are present. And we will first start with our co-chairs, Madel Briggs Melanson.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon. Eliel Oliveira.
Well, good morning for me.
Good morning. Good morning, Eliel. Shyla Blend.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Hans Botzendijk.
Good day today.
Good day to you. Sarah DeSylvie. Steve Eichner.
Happy Monday.
Happy Monday. Hannah Galvin.
Good morning.
Good morning, Hannah. Jim Jurgis. Anna McAllister. Kike Lamo Oshun Kenton. Rochelle Prosser.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Rochelle. Thank you, everyone. Is there anybody who just joined who did not get a chance to indicate their presence? Or anyone I may have missed. All right. Well, thank you. And I will turn it over to our co-chairs for opening remarks.
Thank you so much, Peter. And good, it is good morning, good afternoon, and good day to everyone. It's such a great pleasure to be back in our always engaged and exciting annual report work group today. I was unable to join our last meeting, but I heard that our last meeting, we were able to make so much progress. And so we're going to keep that momentum going and try to get through as much of our crosswalk today as possible. Eliel, I'll turn it on over to you for your opening remarks.
Yes, thank you, Mandel. And yes, good day. I'll keep it that way short to all of you and excited to be here today again and continuing the progress. Yes, I agree. We made some good progress last week, last time we met. So now, you know, we want to continue on that front. So thank you, everyone, for joining again and keeping us moving. And special thank you for Dev to join us as well to discuss some of privacy and security challenges with her experience. So thank you, Devin.
Great. And we can go right on to the next slide. And so one of the things, just a quick overview of today's agenda, is that our next item that we're going to focus on is an update on all the work group plans. Then we're going to go and really spend the vast majority of our time discussing the draft crosswalk of the topics for the high-tech annual report for fiscal year 2024. And as Eliel just mentioned, thank you again. I also want to extend my thank you to Devin for also being on the call today in order to lend all of her expertise, especially in the privacy and security aspects. And then we'll open it up for public comment near the end of our meeting, and then we will adjourn. Next slide. So an update on all of our work group plans. Next slide. So again, we are making progress. We are almost to the halfway mark. And today we will continue to review the crosswalk of topics for the annual report. We'll also reconvene on August 26th in order to tie up any loose ends of those crosswalks as well. On September 9th, that's when we're really going to move more into developing the draft of the annual report, and then also developing that draft and again, fine-tuning those details in order to submit it to the full high tech committee for review. On November 24th, we're going to update the draft with any of the feedback that we received from the HITECH committee in order to then re-present it for final review and approval. And our goal is prior to the end of this calendar year that we will have the annual report completely ready, wrapped up in a nice pretty package in order to submit to our Assistant Secretary Tripathi, as well as the rest of our Secretary Becerra and the rest of Congress. Next slide. In terms of the meeting schedule for the full committee, during this upcoming HITECH meeting, which will be next Thursday, we will provide an update on the annual report development. In particular, we're going to discuss the crosswalk. So that's one of the reasons why this meeting today is so incredibly important. Hopefully, we will be able to get through as much of the crosswalk as possible. And then on September 12th, we will provide another update on the annual report development itself. On October 17th, we will officially review the draft of the annual report. And again, that will be our in-person HITECH committee meeting. And then November 7th, we will bring it back to the committee in order for final approval to be transmitted. Next slide. Great. So what are our tasks that we're charged with? We're in the middle of drafting the crosswalk topics, identifying the gaps, opportunities, and providing the recommended activities across all of the various different target areas. In addition, we will continue to finalize the review of the draft report that all of our colleagues will help to put together, specifically in September, in order to prepare it to be presented to HITECH in October. After all the additional edits, the HITECH votes to approve the report, and it's transmitted to the Assistant Secretary and National Coordinator in November 2024. And then, of course, ASTP-ONC will then forward that final report to the HHS Secretary and Congress for it to be posted on healthit.gov. Next slide. All right. So I think that we can now jump into our business at hand for today. And so once again, we had a wonderful discussion last time. We're able to get through several different topics. However, there was one topic that really could probably use a little bit more time. So we wanted to go back and Excel team, if we can bring up the crosswalk right now. We wanted to go back. Yes, perfect. To provider use of, actually, if we continue to scroll down, was that the last topic? Yes. We wanted to make sure that everyone did have the time to review this last topic before we jump into the privacy and security topics and others, but had enough time to look at this topic in particular and provide as much input as possible. So once again, when we look at the topic, provider use of AI in health and healthcare, the gap there was as AI capabilities continue to grow, there's lack of best practices on where the use of AI is clinically appropriate. The challenge is that problems with data quality, relevance, and usability can contribute to safety issues and incorrect outputs. The opportunity is assisting in identifying best practices for clinically appropriate uses of AI. And then some of the proposed recommended HITECH activities from this past meeting was number one, request that ASTP identify what AI actually is and is not in healthcare, and especially within their scope. And I think that's very, very important in order to help to frame future HITECH AI related work. Explore steps that ASTP in collaboration with other agencies could take to establish best practices for appropriate uses of AI in healthcare. And those areas for best practices could include decision support, reviewing care summaries for relevant information, and assisting patients. And then exploring the need for AI surveillance programs similar to existing surveillance programs for drugs to identify issues such as safety or equity concerns. So there was a large amount of robust activity here, but we just wanted to just start off here to see if there's any other thoughts or comments before we move on to the next section. So let's jump right on in. And I see your hand.
Thank you so much. It occurs to me one thing that we did not address at all is anything about research. We've talked about health and healthcare, but didn't touch on research. And not only the use of AI might be clinically appropriate, but how it might be clinically appropriate. Because those are, I think, two different components.
All very great points, for sure. Any other thoughts as well on this section? And so really making sure that we're also focused on the research aspects of AI and where are some of the safeguards there. Anything else that we think in terms of provider use of AI in health and healthcare?
And again, this is Steve. I just guess to elaborate, the same factors come into play for the use of AI in the research side with respect to looking at health equity issues and looking, ensuring we've got excellent representation of all potentially impacted individuals when we're using AI, regardless of whether we're using it in research, clinical care, et cetera. And I guess that might be another piece of how do we link the use of AI in healthcare to coordinate things with social services?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So it is so incredible. We speak about that all the time during high tech and in so many other domains, the appropriate representation of all of those who may be impacted by all of this emerging technology and making sure the voices are there, the perspectives are there. But as you also mentioned too, this shouldn't just be in a silo for research or clinical care, but also thinking about how do we link up our additional social services and how that impacts, because all of our technology should be used to advance the greater good of all populations. So thank you for all of those different
right. Well, and not just for that, but also in coordination, thinking about the same kinds of things we've been talking about other places, you know, with health information exchange, one of the goals of trying to reduce duplicative entry of information on the patients. Correct. Well, same kind of thoughts about AI from a patient perspective or a provider perspective. How can we implement it once for use across domains so that people aren't having to provide the same information in multiple spaces?
And so that would be a wonderful, it sounds like you're, what you're doing is coming up with some of the proposed recommended activities, and it goes underneath this area of exploration, just to sort of center it and guide it a bit more, is really, again, one, incorporating some of the uses for research in order to advance our overall health and healthcare, but also to identify and mitigate any forms of health inequities that may occur. But then also the coordination across, and that may go a little bit more into number two as well, the coordination across all of not only our agencies, but also our various different service providers. So in order to decrease the burden on both providers and patients in terms of the use of these technologies and the information across the space.
Right. I guess one way of summing it up, and I'll be quiet, is looking at interoperable mm-hmm. AI. Mm-hmm. So that we're looking at cross-provider space again, so that we're not having all of these silos.
Correct. Yes, absolutely. This is throughout, as we've always said, AI is interwoven into all that we do now. And so interoperability is a key area there as well. So thank you for all of those comments and thoughts. Rochelle, I see your hand that's up next.
Hi, Vidal. Thank you so much. Just taking a step off of Ike and all those before me, I had some time to really drill down and think about this particular one a little bit more. And when we think about adults with disabilities and children or young adults with disabilities, are we really actually taking in the components of AI when we bring that into the space? Just as we have our aging population or the aging population with dementia or Alzheimer's, and we want to have them be inclusive in the use of AI, we want to think about our ADA folks out there where they have learning disabilities, but still can use AI with accommodations and tools. And are we actually bringing them into the fold? That's the first question. Are we thinking about those that are ADA compliant? And is AI being used in an ADA compliant way? That's number one. Number two, for our Native Indian or Indian health non-federal proponents, are when we develop AI, are we thinking of them and the Indian health services? Yes, we're talking about public health services, but are we actually being compliant with the laws and tribal laws of their society and to ensure full interoperability there? And then finally, with our LGBTQ populations, are we being socially compliant as well and accepting or inclusive in that space? So those are the three things that came to mind as I thought about this particular one. And I'm so glad that we were able to circle back to it today.
So thank you again for all of those wonderful comments, Rochelle, and just to really kind of bring that together. I think these are all very important points, because one of the things is, although this says provider use of AI, this is also important to look at it from the perspective of the patients themselves and in terms of what is acceptable or not acceptable and what's really going to help to engage them in this entire healthcare experience the same. So whether it's individuals that are living with physical or cognitive disabilities, but then also thinking about some of the specific needs as well in terms of the accessibility and accommodations of these tools, so that providers are being able to be inclusive of this technology with all patients. But then definitely, yes, with our LGBTQ plus community, are there certain things that would be more acceptable? And I would say amongst all of our marginalized populations. And then, you know, I think with the Indian Health Services, we do try to bring in as much of the input as well, of course, from our tribal agency, but really being very thoughtful of saying, yes, let's make sure that we're including this important group of experts and agencies into the space too, to see what's possible. So thank you for that. I mean, these are all great proposed recommended high tech activities so that we can be very explicit with this. And Anna, I see your hand, and Elliot, I'm going to say one quick thing too. One thing I did want to add here, we've spoken about what's clinically appropriate, what's appropriate for research and interoperability, and then also from the patient lens. The one thing I do think that something that I noticed that is missing here, and I know that ASTP doesn't normally frame it this way, but this, like, as a physician, I actually frame it this way, and that is some of the administrative clinical uses of AI itself, because we know that there's a lot of new AI technology that is actually helping or trying to help us be more efficient. However, there's also some privacy kind of questions and concerns, which is why I'm happy that Devin is here as we talk more about some of these areas. But I think it is very important to think about, as this blossoming ecosystem is expanding, also some of the appropriate and important administrative uses of AI in healthcare by providers, because we have to really be thoughtful and make sure that we are still engaging the trust of our patient populations and our communities, while also ensuring that we're not over-relying on some of this admin AI as well. So that's one thing that I wanted to add into the conversation to be captured also. So Anna, I see your hand, and then we'll go to Elio.
Thanks, Madel. I guess, so first of all, my apologies, because the past, I've had conflicts that I couldn't change over the past couple of meetings. So kind of behind the curve in terms of being up to speed on what the prior discussions have been. So my apologies for that. I'm trying to understand a couple of things. One is exactly what is it that we're recommending here? Because what Rochelle just walked through, all that stuff is super important, but it seems to me that this is really focused on provider use of AI in health and healthcare. So, I mean, maybe if you're thinking about training data or that kind of thing. Anyway, I just want to make sure I'm understanding the thing correctly. It looks as if we're just focused on here on telling ONC, ASCP, ONC, that they need to put together some work groups or task forces to really explore this. Am I reading that correctly? So for instance, you know, the big things that I'm concerned about within the context of provider use of AI is stuff like, are they using AI that's been trained with kind of clunky, not so well curated, normalized clinical data. Because like when I look at the data download that I have from my medical record, it's kind of terrifying to think that like that's going to be fed into some sort of an AI algorithm and used for clinical decisions. So there's that. And then the other thing, I mean, there was just something that ran that Zach Kahane posted this morning on LinkedIn about if you took the American Heart Association's risk stratification algorithm and applied it to most people about the use of statins and antihypertensives, that we would see an increase in cardiovascular events and MI. So that's the kind of AI that I'm really concerned about, because you've got the American Heart Association, which everybody kind of respects and says, well, if these guys do say that this is good, then it's got to be good. Like if that would have been incorporated whole cloth into like an Epic or a Cerner EHR or major hospital systems EHR, then the consequences could have been really bad, both in the long term as well as in the short term, in terms of getting access for patients. So, that to me is the kind of stuff that I would like for ONC to really explore. Like, how do we keep the bad things from happening while not creating barriers for the good things to happen? Because we need to have AI in healthcare. It just needs to be done appropriately and with caution.
Absolutely. Thank you, Anna. And yes, this topic is specifically with provider use of AI. However, while also, I think what Rochelle was saying, the consideration of some of the patient aspects of this, but your point is well taken, and that's exactly what this is all about. We know that a lot of our AI data models are not representative. They're not high quality. There's several different gaps. They were taken from multiple different sources. And therefore, if you're going to build clinical algorithms or predictive analytics on them, you have to be incredibly cautious, because they can actually output erroneous information that then clinically will be acted upon. And that's where the challenges come into play here. But I think what you're saying is very, very important. And I'm thinking maybe we can clean this up. We may, from all the comments, we may be able to clean this up on the back end and bring this up back up to our annual report work group, because we do have to make sure all of our proposed recommended activities directly are addressing the challenges that we've identified. And we know that while there's a lot of great good in this, we also want to be very cautious in how we proceed and making sure that ASTP are making those recommendations of how they can assure the quality, the relevance, the usability, and the safety of all of these various different AI algorithms, again, within their scope, because that's always the main thing, or either help to be an influence on the other agencies as well. So Anna, I agree exactly what you're saying. Like, our recommendations for this, while they're so incredibly broad and so many implications, we do also have to think about how we think about from a provider lens, but also taking in that patient voice and perspective too. So thank you.
Yeah, well, I mean, I care a lot about the patient voice and perspective. So that, Rochelle, was not meant in any way as a criticism. I'm just trying to get my head around exactly what we're trying to focus on. But I think regardless of whether you have a rare disease or come from an ethnic or tribal minority or whatever, if you need heart medication, you want your heart medication. I mean, so like the AHA algorithm would not necessarily be a good thing regardless of you know, skin color, ethnic, you know, whatever. So that too is a big patient concern.
100%. Yes. Thank you, Anna. And then we'll go to Eliel, and then I'm going to turn it on over to him for us to jump into the other section.
Yeah. So I agree, Anna. What we are trying to achieve here is exactly in line with what you're saying, which is AI is basically taking the world by, you know, by surprise, if you will, if not really. I mean, I've been dealing with AI for close to 30 years now, but now it's the genie is out of the lamp, right? I guess so. Everybody's looking at it, and there is so much every day that we all seeing happening in healthcare, specifically with the AI. Some of which are very useful, like Medel was saying, in terms of like administrative tools. But we are basically trying to highlight here what are the areas of concern, right? Without impeding, you know, the evolution as well to deliver better care to all. So I think this is, if I was thinking about this, there are two things that come to mind. One, we have that column there, proposed tier. This to me is tier number one right away, because I think this is so important and we see the movement coming and not stopping. The second thing I was going to say on the proposed recommendations is you all saw last week the announcement by ESTP ONC on data, chief technology officer, chief data officer, chief AI officer. They all to me kind of fall under this umbrella and somehow coming to, you know, strategize with us and with others what this should look like. And what I mean by that is like the points that Steve is making were terrific, and same for Rochelle and you. There's so much here that needs to be addressed, and we just don't have a framework. And I think those individuals that HHSC are bringing into the table could be very helpful in, with this group and HITACH to kind of just look at what we did last time we had an in-person meeting and the hearing that we had. These discussions here, but really start opening this up to develop exactly what is the framework that we're talking about here. How do we qualify AI that's for administrative purposes, AI that's for clinical care, decision support, AI for some other purposes, this is public health, like Steve is saying. And then once we have these categories, which I'm just making them up as we go here, how do we then formalize the process by which they become usable? And I don't know what that definition is here either, but I think that's where a task force, these new hires that ONC, ESTP is bringing up to the table could help us kind of organize. I think like Peter Ambi presented in our in-person, hearing, a framework on how data, AI, and research could work. We have done the same thing in our projects here at Harvard, but I think it's still open out there, right? There has not been any clear definition. So maybe the proposed recommendation is for us to bring in these new leaders and HITACH to develop a task force to just work on this. And I think it's going to take a while for us to formalize how AI is going to work in healthcare fully. Sorry, that was quite a bit. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Okay, excellent discussion. All right, and so any other items, let's think about this, but we're going to take all of the feedback, and then when we come back to our next meeting, we'll make sure that this crosswalk is a little bit more defined and a little bit more clear in terms of all of the different comments that was mentioned. So thank you all for that. So let's keep on moving through the crosswalk. Great. And we get to go to privacy and security. So Eliel, I'll turn this on over to you to walk us through this target area.
Thanks, Madel. And again, thanks, Devin, from joining us. We're excited to hear your thoughts as well. There's quite a bit here in privacy and security. And as you all know, this is an ongoing target area for the annual report. So we started with the first one here, which is, you know, privacy of sensitive health data in general, right? The gap that we see is that there's still a lack of consensus on the definition of sensitive health data and how to implement data segmentation. The challenge is the health IT infrastructure has a limited ability to support identifying and segmenting coded and discrete data that's considered sensitive, and their ability to manage applicable privacy and security rules that apply to sensitive health data, including behavioral health data, presents a challenge to exchange for providers. The opportunity that we see, we can gain a consensus on the definition of sensitive data and examine opportunities to increase the availability of certified health IT modules that can manage applicable privacy and security rules to enable data exchange, including for behavioral health. And then we had some proposed activities here on that front right away, which would be to evaluate the current models and suggest steps toward a terminology value set for sensitive health data elements that could be widely adopted. And then we added that we could explore additional certification needs for health IT systems to support the privacy and security of sensitive data with acute and ambulatory providers that have already adopted certified IT modules, including the needs of behavioral health providers and others that still do not use certified EHR systems. So with that, that's high level how we're thinking that we needed to maybe improve the exchange of information by clearly defining what sensitive health data is, and be able to collaborate across, you know, different types of providers that may or may not use certified systems. So with that, I'll stop there and see if any thoughts. Hans, I see your hand up.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I have a couple of thoughts and not a clear recommendation or suggestion yet, but a couple of things. And I'm kind of reading both the sensitive data, the general and the consent kind of together. And so some of the comments will blend. I think some of the terminology that we use, like data segmentation, give an impression that we are isolating data and store it separately. I think we very much want to make sure that in the terminology that we use, that it's about recognizing, categorizing data, that we understand what we can do with it. Not necessarily that it means that it's physically isolated, but that we, as a result, are not sharing it or are sharing it with whoever sits on the other side that that can get that. So I think we just want to be careful with the term segmentation as not being a physical intent. And within sensitive data, I think it's increasingly helpful, I think, that we distinguish between the actual data that we can recognize directly that is sensitive, actual condition codes, procedure codes, medications, and otherwise, and categories or of data that a document can contain sensitive data, but there's a sensitive flag to indicate there is something in here, which is not the same. So sensitive data, we need to make sure that we interpret that broadly, not just the individual data, but as part of data sets and documents that it contains there. The last comment is around the focus on certifying health IT modules, where I think we need to be very broad again as well, because when we're looking at it, there are the elements of what does an, if you will, I'm not just specifically going to use an EHR as a data source, but the actual privacy rules that drive what data can be shared may be kept completely in a different area that is centrally accessible, where all the privacy rules across a jurisdiction may be available at whatever level will you do that. So it's not only that we need to look at the typical IT modules that we think about, the EHRs, the data source that holds it, what does it need to do? But what are these other modules that enable privacy rules to be computably documented, shareable, that I have access to it, and do the same on the consent side for the patient, that their rules are available, which may not be in the EHR itself. It might be somewhere else because that's where the central store for that patient is. So I think we just from the terminology perspective, we don't want to give the impression that everything, and I'm going to put it a little bit more extreme than I know it's intended, that everything must be part of an EHR. It's actually all those modules together that are going to make it happen, and therefore there also needs to be the infrastructure that as an EHR. I know where to get access to the privacy rules. I know where to get access to the patient consent. It could be in mine, but it might be in somebody else's. It might be kept with the state. It might be kept with whomever. So how do we do that in a much more federated model than assume that everything is EHR-centric? And some of the terminology that we have right now, based on the history behind how we came about certification and everything else, implies for many people a EHR-specific focus. I think we have to step away from that. It's not just the EHR that's going to solve it.
These are excellent thoughts, Hans. And as you're speaking, I'm just taking my mind to my HIE, you know, role, which we deal with, you know, HIPAA data for TPO constantly, which basically means we have a clear definition of what are the 18 data elements that are considered PHI and when we can allow someone to access or not, and for what reasons, and the tools that we'll build for exchange even allow that. For I'll give an example, right? So when someone is on an EMS truck, EMS access the health information exchange to get records about that patient, that it's the first time the EMS is visiting them or seeing them, right? So it's not technically their patient, but it is right now. So they break the glass, and there is a feature in the, you know, the technology that uses that allows that to happen, so that in an emergency, someone can look at the records if it's not their patient. It's very clearly laid out, and the technology allows that to happen for the, those use cases, right? But we don't have that same pathway. At least I have been enough in the HIE space that many of us just decide not to store and manage a 42 CFR part two data because we don't know the variability of what can be done in what situations and what providers and in different states. So I think what you're describing, it falls in line on like how more specifically we define this, being careful with the segmentation aspect. We are not putting things in different places. That's like how HIEs manage data, right? Everything is in one place, but we do know for TPO what can be done and not done, but I don't think for behavioral health and a few other aspects. So thank you for those thoughts. Those are right on the line, in line with what we are trying to do here. I see, Devin, you have your hand up as well.
I do. Thank you. A couple of thoughts. So one, largely agreeing with Hans's comments, although there is one class of data for which the protections do assume that that data is kept separately, and that's psychotherapy notes. The additional protections in the HIPAA privacy rule for psychotherapy notes only apply if that data is separate from the other data. I don't know that there are any other laws that sort of affirmatively require separateness, but just as a note, there are some circumstances where it has to be separately kept separate, or else the additional protections actually don't apply. And that's psychotherapy notes in HIPAA. The second thing I'll say is that I don't know that there's a value proposition to getting consensus on sensitive data, because we do have some laws that require certain types and categories of data to be usually subject to additional consent, which then begs the question about whether we've got two separate, why we need two separate categories here, one on consent and one on protections for sensitive data, since most of the time, except the example I just provided around the separateness requirement, it's really about additional consent requirements that might attach. But you have sort of the right of people to ask for restrictions. It doesn't necessarily have to be honored in the case of HIPAA, but that allows the individual to determine what constitutes a sensitive data point for them. In the context of domestic violence, for example, there are classes of data that might be very sensitive that otherwise we would not consider generally, just looking at them on their face, to be sensitive. And it really is it personally dependent. So I personally don't see the value proposition around trying to define what constitutes sensitive data versus assuming that there will be data that needs additional protection, some of it due to law, some of it due to patient sensitivity, and then what happens from there. The other thing I'll say about part two is that might be worth further exploration because the law has changed in terms of your ability to do TPO with behavioral health data that is subject to part two. Once you get an initial consent that can be much broader than it used to be, it doesn't have to be, you know, provider specific anymore. So there are lots of opportunities there to think both from a policy and technology perspective about how to enable the sharing of data, because it was intentionally, those rules were intentionally changed to try to treat it more like TPO, frankly. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Devin. Go ahead, Adele.
Eliel, there may be some questions for Devin. And so I just wanted to like open that up because Devin, thank you. That was incredibly yes. helpful. Are there any questions for Devin? Because Devin is here as our subject matter expert in this space.
And so, Hannah's a subject and SME too. So
yes, Hannah's a subject matter expert on many different topics. but I just wanted to just quickly pause to see if there's any questions. I did have a question for Devin, but are there any other questions specifically for Devin on what she just mentioned?
Actually, I did. Thank you, Devin, for clarifying that. When we are, my thoughts on the proposal here was to ensure that we can have a proper follow-up in understanding that in the behavioral health space, you recommend and send for treatment, but there are so many TPO protections there that you mention that it becomes almost impossible for the treating physicians or the working in collaboration physicians to ensure that the patient went to treatment or even verified that they did show up or even made the appointment. Like it's just that basic level of communication. And so my understanding of what was being proposed is just that we can trust but verify, not necessarily want to delve into the protectiveness of are they in psychotherapy or what was actually being done. You can see sometimes on the claims data that they are, but you can't even verify with that provider, did they actually show up in your office? And so this is where my thinking was in looking at the interoperability and providing a little bit of a lifting of the veil, not necessarily on the protected health data, but just the basic communications. And I don't know if anyone else is thinking of it in this terms, and I would love clarification on that.
Yeah, and well, Rich, and Deva, before you answer, I'll jump in and add mine to that too, because it's a little bit like Rochelle. I would love to, for clarification. So for instance, in my role, I oversee gender health. And so especially when it comes to gender affirming treatment, when it comes to reproductive rights, and we know that there's a lot of efforts going on across the country that are with variation in terms of what is acceptable or not acceptable in certain states. So in my mind, also the privacy of sensitive health data was for some of these other areas, including behavioral health, in order to allow protection for patients as well as for the providers also. So would just love to get some of your thoughts on that.
Can I add another twist here, Devin? It's like, in my case here, we are dealing with individuals that are part of the incarceration system and are being treated in clinics in incarceration system. And we are trying to help by integrating data to the, but I guess like Rochelle was saying, it's like, we don't necessarily need it to the details about the clinical aspects itself, but just the fact that someone is coming out of the incarceration system, we don't know what to do with that. Do we tell the providers or not? And what are the local and regional, state, federal limitations to do that? It becomes very tricky. So we ended up not doing anything and not helping as much.
Yeah, I mean, that happens a lot, is the sense that this data has too much, you know, laden down in terms of, you know, laws to and sensitivity. So we just won't deal with it like that. Definitely has historically happened. I'll say a couple of things in response to some of these comments. So first off, the protections for psychotherapy notes are not protections for the fact that someone is in psychotherapy or even whether they attended the appointment or not. It's the notes from the session. That's it. The notes from the session. So someone taking notes during about what was said in the session, that's the only thing that applies to. It doesn't apply to the drugs, doesn't apply to the fact that someone was in psychotherapy. Similarly, around the, you know, some of the part two provisions, again, I think it is worth a more complete exploration of the ways that those laws have changed, because I think it really has not sunk in. People are still operating under the old framework and not even reconsidering what the possibilities are. There's still a consent required, but it can be obtained at the initial start of treatment. It can apply broadly to subsequent care. So it's just much more, I don't want to say malleable, that's probably not exactly the right word, but it's much more workable than the prior part used to be. Prisoners often particular laws associated with prison medical systems and what kind of information can be disclosed might require a much deeper dive into continuity of care for people in the justice system when they're released and then, you know, obtaining care outside of that system, or even the back and forth nature of some of that with respect to certain populations where they might cycle in and out, mostly of jail, not prison. But there are some complications associated with that that don't exist for populations that are not in the justice involved piece of it. Maybe it's worth some further exploration. But I think there's definitely room for much greater education about what's possible, because I think some of what holds us back is overly conservative interpretation and not sort of a full appreciation of what the new laws, what kinds of behaviors are going to be permissible under the new provisions on part two. I don't know if I covered all of it. There was a lot.
Yeah. I might
miss something.
There's a lot there, Devin, but I think you nail on the head, which is, yes, there is over-conservative ways to manage because folks are just not clear, and that's as well. So,
yeah, I used to get, when I was working for the Office for Civil Rights, I would often get, HIPAA won't let us do X. I'm like, that isn't true. HIPAA totally lets you do that. I don't know who told you it didn't, but, you know, I can't get, I can't go at, you know, as a regulator, I couldn't tell people, well, you know, you're claiming HIPAA says you can't share when you can. That's frankly what the information blocking rules were supposed to be about. Like, don't hide behind, you know, HIPAA if it's not true. At the same time, like, it's mostly an issue of misinterpretation over many, many years. I'll stop.
And do you mind just addressing what our other co-chair with the maternal health and additional vulnerable population protections?
Yeah. So this is another one where, you know, I feel like it's very similar to the domestic violence example that I gave earlier, which is it's the kind of care that might frankly not be subject to a particular law that protects it. But it may in fact be quite sensitive in the eyes of the patient who's receiving that care or the medical provider who is providing that care in terms of a desire to create some protections around how it gets shared going forward. And it's the reason why I think we need to be careful about saying that we have to define what constitutes sensitive data, because perceived gender or gender in many contexts is not considered to be sensitive, but in some contexts, in fact, it is sensitive. If it's not, if the gender isn't the gender from birth any longer, or has been changed in some way. So, or not, like that, you know, you all know the circumstances far better than I do, but I just think it's another example. And then reproductive health, of course, many states have passed. There always were protections in the law. And then after the Dobbs decision, there are even more protections in certain states around the sharing of that data. And I would bucket the repro health piece, repro laws in the bucket of, now we've got law in addition to maybe where you don't have law and there's just sensitivities expressed by the patient and or the, in the case of reproductive health, the medical provider who may in fact be in jeopardy when that data flows to places where it could be used against that medical provider. It's just a danger associated with, all right, we're going to define and get consensus on what constitutes sensitivity, because it's going to be contextual in many cases, or legal in some cases. And we just, I think, need to be careful about that.
Thank you so much, Devin. And all those thoughts and questions, I think that highlights really well the importance of education. I think I don't feel comfortable in many of the situations that we're talking about here. I mean, I'm hearing, I guess, that others feel the same way. So I'm thinking about even how to go about this. It's such a big challenge, and how you strategically plan to address these all the time. It's because I think one thing I heard from you, Devin, before was that We have talking about privacy and security for a while, and it goes back in rounds. And I'm like, how do we then at least put a plan forward that allows us to make incremental, you know, adjustments or just educational aspects to solve some of these? Because otherwise we come back to the same challenges again, and nobody knows what to do, and we ended up doing nothing, you know, overall.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Eliel, I like that. That's a great segue to some of my comments, right? So I do want to say, like, I 100% agree with Devin, right? And we have been, Devin and I have been working closely in this space for a number of years. And to that point, right, we do have some history of stakeholders trying to look at data elements, right, element by element, and saying, is this sensitive? Is this not sensitive? Is this sensitive? Is this not sensitive? And it has not been effective, right? So this is not sort of without trying and without precedent, right? But looking at the laws and looking, right, at state by state laws as well as federal laws, and I put a link in the chat that came out recently where a group went through and tried to analyze the reproductive health laws, right, state by state post-Dobbs. And as Devin says, right, adolescence is big, right? But looking at it from a legal area, but legal aspect, but also, as Devin astutely mentioned, right, there is a lot of data that is sensitive just because it is sensitive to me, right? Because of my previous experience and stigma that may not be protected by law. So some of the functionality that we are building allows for kind of algorithmic definition based on the law, as well as, you know, patient specific requests under HIPAA, the requested redactions. And I think what you're getting to is really what I wanted to get to is, okay, what are the next steps here? Because we do have people working on terminology value sets right now. The National Association of Community Health Centers has done some great work and is doing some great work with Stephen Lane and with Shift moving forward to try to come up with terminology value sets. And early on in that process, but there is some work being done on that. There is work being done on standards and maturing the standards around this. And so what are sort of our next steps to kind of move this forward as opposed to continuing to sort of spin on it? And every time we sort of bring it up, people are like, yeah, this is really hard. Like, insensitive data is really hard. And my recommendation there is really working through TEFCA. And working through an SOP in TEFCA as we think about certification to right, I would advocate that there be a TEFCA SOP requiring granular data privacy protections and consent, and bringing these two together as I think Eliel, you may have, or someone else recommended that these two sort of really go together. And Devin is the co-chair of the Sequoia Privacy Consent Work Group that several of us are also part of. But I see that as the sort of pathway to getting this implemented. And Devin, I don't know if you want to speak to this further, but I see that as, right, the Shift is doing a lot of work on the standards development, on the terminology pieces, but in order to kind of get this moving forward from a sort of policy perspective, I would work through the TEFCA framework.
If before Devin responds, this is Steve Eitner, I want to add in just one or two real fast points. Number one, looking at confidentiality as well and patient consent, where does that actually fit in with sharing under PTO? So if we're looking at making a recommendation under sharing data under TEFCA, there also needs to be, I think, a tie-in as to what's permissible sharing under PTO, because operations can be a large opportunity for sharing data. And how does that actually mesh in with patient preferences and patient consent in this new space?
So
you need a framework where patients really can control what information is being shared in different environments And again, looking at the accountability on the backside about where is this data actually being shared. Right now, there's nothing in TEFCA that has any audit facility at all for reviewing what information is actually being shared. And if disclosures that are PTO don't have to be recorded, there's really no method for a patient to audit what was released under PTO.
Yes. So I'm going to pause this for a moment. I'm going to try to get us back on track. I know there's a lot of robust conversation, but I want to make sure that everyone gets a chance to speak. And I know Hans has patiently had his hand up, and then Ike will come back. And I know, Shyla, I saw that you had a comment. So, and we're going to run through this because we still have a lot of things to talk about. So Hans, please let us know some of your thoughts, and then we'll continue to go back through if there's any additional thoughts.
Thank you, Manuela. There may be two comments. So one in reaction to Devin and this last conversation of can we define sensitive data, and the other one on TEFCA or the scope of what we need to address. Maybe starting with the last one first, because that's a little bit easier in a way. We need to make sure that this works, no matter whether there's a TEFCA, HIE, state, whatever, in between. There's a lot of communication going on for a long time to come that is not necessarily going through a network. It might facilitate some things, but it will be a long time coming before that is all in place. So I think we have to always look at it. It can work regardless of whether it's a TEFCA or whether there's an HIE or whether there's a state, HIE or whatever. It just needs to work dynamically in some fashion. That doesn't mean that they could not be helping helpful stepping stones to get some wider adoption. So in that sense, agreed. But the solution cannot be dependent on it. The other part is to the sensitive data. I would agree and understand that that we cannot define all the sensitive data, and perhaps we need to clarify that we need to have computable rules, which in turn need to understand exactly what data is subject to that rule. And unless we aim for that, which is not going to be easy, but we are bound to require that every transaction is going to be human reviewed. And that's not what we'd like to have either, facilitate expedient, proper exchange of the data that the right people can get it, and the right people or the people that are not authorized to get it are not going to get it based on the automated exchange of data that's happening, automatic queries, preparation for a next visit, what am I going to share? So I would be cautious that we say we don't need to know the sensitive data. In a way, we do. But it might not be that we have to define a set that is fixed or changeable in that fashion. But the rule, whether it's a California rule or a Maryland rule or a my rule as a patient, as a directive, I need to tie it to the actual characteristics of the data, so that either the data itself is a certain condition I don't want to share, or a certain lab result I don't want to share, certain demographics that I don't want to share, whatever. And if that's contained in a document, I have agreement on what the flags are, because as that data is moving around, we don't want to have to chase that data down and say, oh, Hans changed his mind. Today he was willing to share, tomorrow he's not. If the data is unique to the data source, but not to us collectively, I'm not going to be able to chase down where the data has gone. So I think there is an element of sensitive data that has to be defined so I can compute it. Because unless we are willing to accept that that people are always going to have to evaluate every query that comes in, whether it's FHIR-based, CDA-based, version 2-based, whatever-based, proprietary, and that we need to share, that they have to evaluate that. And I don't think that was what we're trying to achieve with interoperability. But we want to make sure the right person has access and the wrong person does not have access. How do we do that in a supportive fashion?
Excellent points, Hans. Thank you so much for that. And so, you know, I think we're now starting to coalesce on some of the different thoughts or recommendations that we have. So it may not be the specific subsets, but the definitions of what sensitive health data is, and then allowance of some of those specific flaggings, but it has to be consistent across the various different forms of technology. So thank you for that, Hans. Any other thoughts or comments on this topic? Obviously, there's a lot that we have to think of. What I ask the work group is for us to continue to think about this. Our teams at ASTP will actually try to put all of our comments together and we'll try to revise some of this. But I please ask for you all to continue to think and provide your comments even offline so that we can get this as tight and as impactful as what we would want it to be. So any other thoughts or comments here? Shyla, I know I did see your hand. I want to make sure we don't miss you.
Oh, I was just going to reiterate. I was going to punch in the comments. A lot said what I was thinking is that as we look at this technology and especially the 42 CFR, I know one of the challenges is that HIEs can assist a lot, but there needs to be the consent management, the ability to do that consent. And I know a challenge right now for many is, you know, if a patient withdraws that consent, how they handle that. And so ensuring whatever we recommend that the capabilities are there, that it helps, enhance the sharing with the privacy laws in place instead of restricting it. And I see with other comments, and since others have commented, that that point I feel has been brought across.
Wonderful. Well, your points are also very well taken. So thank you so much for sharing them with us. All right. So wonderful, robust conversation. So much for us to think of. Please, as we continue on before our next meeting, if you have other thoughts, please let's send them in so that we can coalesce them together. And then when we review the crosswalk next meeting, we can have some of this a little bit more defined about what our recommendations are. Excellent. All right, Excel, let's keep on going. Let's see how much else we can actually review, also still within this target area. There we go. So the next piece here, the next two topics is lack of disclosure accountability. And I think that's what it is because all the rest is redlined. And so patients have limited transparency into how their health data is shared. The challenge is with the growth in exchange, it is important to balance increased transparency to consumers with the burden on organizations that hold data to provide an accounting of disclosures. The opportunity we have is to define a long-term roadmap to implement accounting of disclosures. And at least some of the initial proposed recommended high-tech activities includes propose an initial foundation for implementing accounting of disclosures, and then recommend a simplified model of accounting of disclosures that is concise, involves patients in its development, and considers readers' health literacy level. All right, well, pause there. Any initial thoughts or additions to this area? Yes, Devin.
So this is one where I think I might be teed up to give you all a bit more background about how this issue came to a predecessor committee, the one that was established under HITECH, the Federal Health IT Policy Committee, which did a hearing on this issue, collected testimony on this issue, came up with a set of recommendations, and I'm not sure that the capabilities of EHRs have gotten any better in terms of being able to isolate disclosures that come out of a provider organization that go outside to somebody else versus when somebody just accesses a record internally. And there's a whole history of OCR attempting to initially address accounting of disclosures, which already was expanded to include TPO disclosures in HITECH for electronic health record data. That there is, they originally said what patients should get is an access report. Anytime someone hit the record, that should be whether it's a disclosure or just an internal access, since there's no way to tell the difference, we'll give patients all of it. And that was flatly, we got a lot of concerns expressed in the healthcare provider community about that. And so consequently, a different set of recommendations came out of the Health IT Policy Committee, which I don't have in front of me. I was intending to be prepared next time to talk about it. Having said all of that, as we move into networked environments, there might be far greater opportunities to create records of when someone's data has moved through these systems. The answer to that may be, it's not any easier than it was to account for disclosures out of an EMR. But that may be worth exploring, because then you have an opportunity to actually get at disclosures that left the facility in some more consistent way versus, the report of access that frankly could reach from the floor to the ceiling if it were printed out on paper, depending on the complexity of a person's condition for any particular episode of care. So at any rate, I'll stop there, but I was asked to do more, to provide you with a little bit more background on this at a meeting that's coming up in a couple of weeks.
Oh, great. And already the context that you provided, that's very helpful. And especially sort of that recommendation of, is it all disclosures within internally, but really looking at the disclosures externally, if I understand that correctly, because those, of course, would be some of the most high risk forms of disclosures that we should take a look at. So no, that's wonderful. And we look forward to even more context in the upcoming meeting. So thank you for that. Anna, I see your hand as well.
Devin knows how much these issues mean to me. She and I have had many discussions about these issues. Both this one and the following one are ones that sort of drive me crazy. I mean, the only comment that I would make to Devin is that, I mean, it's been a while since that report came out. And if it hasn't advanced, it should have advanced. So part of what we're doing, if the capabilities, technical capabilities have not advanced, it should have advanced. So, I mean, I don't know. I have no ability to assess, where we are. And I was not involved. I was not a member of the HIT policy committee and was not involved in that process, but I remember what was going on. Part of what we're doing here, I mean, the point of what we're doing here is recommending to ONC and I guess also to Congress, what are the kinds of things that need to be prioritized? And I feel like unless we say this has to be a priority, it's never going to happen. And I hear you in terms of like the stack of paper, if you print it out, there'd be a stack of paper from here to the ceiling in terms of like the number of incidental data access points within a hospital. There's got to be a way to like summarize those or categorize, administrative access for billing or processing or physician access. There's got to be a way to sort of summarize those accesses up into a type of category that could be shared. So again, obviously you've spent more time focusing on this than I have, but I feel like we have to demand that this is a priority. Otherwise, it's never going to happen.
All good points, Anna. And Devin, do you know if there's been any additional, or even Hannah, because I know you're also in the space, if there's been any additional movement with trying to see where our current state is in terms of capturing and monitoring account disclosures?
I don't believe so. There's never been any rulemaking from OCR to implement the high tech provision after they initially proposed the access report and never finalized it. I was actually told when I was at OCR and we had got a new director in the change of administrations, he was very frustrated. Why hasn't this been done yet? It's been years. Still didn't do it during his term either. There were at the time a series of technical challenges associated with it that didn't get addressed. There were recommendations to pilot technologies to do it, not ever done. It remains one of those unimplemented provisions for a bunch of reasons. But yeah, it's always helpful to sort of explore what happened before, in what way are we in a different space now, and how can we move this forward?
And Devin, remind me, this like is written into, I feel like you've told me before that this is actually written into statute somewhere.
Oh, it is. It's high tech. It's in the high tech law. TPO exception does not apply when you are disclosing information out of an electronic medical record. But if OCR doesn't do regulations to implement it, and they'd be the ones to enforce it, then it's just like, you know, it's not worth the paper it's written on.
And that's 20 years old, I think.
Yeah, that was 2009.
Yeah. So unless we, like, as a work group, annual report work group, say, this is a priority, folks. It's been 20 freaking years. It's written into statute. Nobody's taking it on.
Yeah, but my preference would be to have a way to implement it that isn't continuing to throw bricks at an immovable wall.
So this is obviously a very clear opportunity for improvement and opportunity to explore, and also possibly a recommendation from our work group and HITACH to explore how to do this and in the appropriate way to remove those barriers. So all excellent, excellent insights. Hannah, I see your hand as well.
Yeah, so what I'll add here actually pertains to both this and the next topic as well, right? All of the conversations that I have had around this, right? There, as Devin mentions, there are technical limitations to this, all of the ways that the data is shared across the ecosystem. There are also operational and educational concerns that typically come up in these conversations, right? At which goes to the next topic as well. The ecosystem and the ways that data is shared is so complicated, right? And I think many patients have a sense that my primary care doctor is sharing data with my specialists and maybe with my pharmacy and radiologist, and maybe that's it, right? But most individuals don't have a great understanding of value-based care, right? And how reimbursement really works, or the fact that when you send a prescription to the pharmacy, it goes through a pharmacy benefit manager, right? And somebody there may take a look at the data in order to determine benefits eligibility, right? And so if you open this up and say, okay, anybody who has looked at the patient's data, a report will be generated. A lot of underlying education is needed first to understand, where is all the data going? Sort of same thing with de-identified data. Where is all the data going? In order to sort of not cause mass confusion, right? And to say, why is this person at this organization that I've never heard of, you know, taking a look at my data? And so if I was going to think about this in a stepwise approach, I think there are some technical pieces, but there's also some baseline understanding of and baseline education of what are all the ways in which my data is shared that needs to be, right? That might be a first step to getting there, because I think when these conversations have happened in the past, part of that brick wall that has been hit was, well, this is too complicated to do because patients are going to be afraid, or not even afraid, but like are going to say, what, you know, why did this person have access to my data? And they're not going to be able to understand sort of all of the pieces of the infrastructure. Interested in Anna's perspective on that. But if I was going to think about a multiple step approach to get there, I might start with getting over that hurdle so that we can then get there, right, in maybe a multi-year framework.
Excellent. Multi-frame framework in order to step us towards, but again, making sure the awareness and knowledge of what the appropriate sharing and disclosure of data is versus what we would be concerned about. Thank you, Hannah. Anna, we'll talk about that, and then we're going to go on to the next topic, which is all related to this as well.
Yeah, I mean, the next topic is something that, like, I mean, this has been a thing that I've been talking about on different panels or so for more than a decade, that it kind of drives me bonkers. I mean, and I come to this as somebody who, you know, my first foray into health IT was doing a company do big data analytics of de-identified electronic health record data. I think it's absolutely essential that we have secondary use of data and research. That's critical in so many ways. However, it's people need to understand how their data is being used and by whom. And, you know, I've been talking about this for a while, and I work with different clients. I got one of my clients to actually issue a data use transparency and impact report, which I've shared with this group before. Happy to share it again. And the response from patients was one of excitement. to be able to see how the de-identified data from their de-identified data have been used to advance research. There was, I mean, the patients who took the time to read it were very excited. So I think that it's an important thing if we want the ecosystem of real world data and real world evidence to develop and thrive, that people really understand the many ways in which their data is being used. Having said that, I think there are probably a fair number of actors in the secondary data use world that would kind of creep people out if they knew their data was being accessed. So, but that doesn't mean that, I think that makes it triply important that these type of transparency disclosures are essential. And I mean, HIPAA gives the market appropriately, again, I think secondary data is essential. HIPAA gives a lot of latitude to take data, de-identify it, and sell it. And I'm all for a market, because unless you have a good market for data, you're never going to get data that's any kind of like shape that's going to make any sense from an analytical perspective. But like, that needs to be disclosed. We have a responsibility to the individuals from whom that data originated to disclose how their data is being used and by whom. And it's not something that isn't doable. The education won't happen unless the disclosures happen. So you can't, if we wait until the education is done, first of all, nobody's going to care that much. In terms of like patients, it might be moderately interesting, but they'll care after they see how their data has been used. But if companies are concerned about how patients will react when they see how they have used their data, they'll come up with the educational materials. But if you wait for the education to come before the data transparency is done, it's not going to happen.
Thank you, Anna. And it's, and you know, it's right. Is it the chicken or the egg right now about what we need to do? But we all recognize the importance of the education and transparency, and making sure that we are equipping our patients with all the knowledge that they have. And so, Anna, your comments were perfect to go directly into this. And I want to just, you already sort of commented on the transparency and use of de-identified data and provided your insights. I want to formally go through this topic and see if there's any other additions to it. So once again, the gap here is that patients have limited understanding and transparency into how their de-identified health data are shared. We already started this conversation with Anna and Hannah and Devin. There is currently no consensus on how to provide patients with a description of how de-identified data are shared. And opportunities to learn more about patient preferences for disclosures about the sharing of their de-identified data. And it may also be making sure, again, that we do have the appropriate education at is another opportunity. And at least the proposed recommendations right now, but I've already heard some others, explore patient preferences for disclosures about the sharing of their de-identified health data, explore opportunities to encourage healthcare organizations to regularly provide increased transparency into how to use de-identified data as well. And again, as everyone said, it does kind of flip back to even the past one, because even the proposed recommended high-tech activities for the first topic on the page is recommend a simplified model of not only accounting, but also likely the education to also support the awareness for our patients. So any additional comments on this topic, the transparency and use of de-identified data? I see lots of comments right now going on in the chat too. So Ike, I see your hand.
Really, I think not only patient preferences for disclosures, but patient preferences in their role in making disclosures or approving disclosures is also important. How do we get patients, or what's patient role in actually making determinations about when and how their data is shared?
Correct, correct. And Ike, you were going out just a little bit, at least on my end at the very end, but also the role that providers should play in terms of increasing that awareness of transparency, correct? Is that what the comment was?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you, Ike. Any other comments or thoughts? Okay.
I would just add that I think I would caution us against giving patients, trying to come up with ways for patients to approve disclosures before we do transparency, just because it's going to make it really, really complicated and it's going to slow down transparency. So I think the demand for the ability to choose whether or not your data is disclosed can come after the transparency. But if we try to do them both concurrently, we're never going to get transparency.
Anna, can you do me a favor? I just want to make sure everybody's clear, and especially also for the record, when you say transparency, can you explain what you are referring to in terms of transparency? Because I think it has some additional kind of insights and implications.
So I can share again, like the data use transparency and impact report that my client put out, because I think it's a great example of how it could be done. In that case, it was an overview of both internal and external uses of de-identified data, patient data. In this case, it was a genetic testing company, and they used their data, you know, internally to do a number of things, such as improving algorithms, et cetera. But externally, they shared it and used it for research and allowed others to use it for research. And in that case, it was a list of all the research that had been generated from de-identified patient data. And again, it's something that patients, I mean, I anticipated that this would be the case, but patients responded very positively to it because it was a lot of incredibly important and compelling research. So that's the kind of thing that I'm, you know, and if, I mean, I, based off the way that my insurance company is now approving certain medication requests from my physicians, I've had some of my kidneys and values of, they have access to my data that's identified, which I probably, I mean, somewhere along the line, I consented to that, but like, I have no knowledge of that other than the fact that suddenly they're approving things that they fought me on for years. But like, we need to have, you know, if LabCorp is sharing data with my insurance company, they need to disclose in some sort of an annual report, these are the companies that we share your data with.
Right. And why? Yeah. And why?
Correct. Yeah. Yes. Is it research? You know, yes. In which case, awesome. That's great. Do what you want. But like, tell me, be upfront about it, about, you know, who are the companies with whom you have relationships that you are sharing my data with?
Wonderful.
So that I can know.
Absolutely. Thank you, Anna. Thank you for that clarification. We have to move to public comment. So Rochelle and Hannah, I know you have your hands up, but we're going to move to public comment. You're happy to put it in the chat. If we do have 1 or 2 minutes, then we will definitely come back for very short kind of wrap up comments. But I will turn it on over to Peter so we can start public comment.
Great. Thanks so much, Madel. So yes, at this time, we would like to open the meeting for public comment. If you are on Zoom and would like to make a comment, please use the hand raise function, which is located on the Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. If you are just joining by phone only today, you can press *9 to raise your hand and get in the queue. Once called upon, press *6 to mute and unmute your line. And I will pause to see if there are any hands that are raised on the Zoom. Not seeing any. And just a reminder that all high-tech meeting materials are posted on healthit.gov. Not seeing any hands raised, and there are no comments through phone at this time. So, Madel, I can yield the time back to you.
All right. Thank you, Peter. So if we can do rapid fire, meaning 30 seconds or less, we can get some of the last comments in. So Hannah or Rochelle, did you want to do a quick rapid fire?
No, rapid fire was, I had a lot of comments. I had a lot of my thoughts in the comments, and I want to understand that, I want the public to understand that I'm not necessarily looking at it from a punitive aspect. Sometimes you need to say, okay, we hold the purse strings. If we don't do this, then we will we will cordon off a portion until you do so and educate the public on that aspect. So I was just talking about if we are in the right genre or space to do so when discussing that. So thank you for your time, Madel.
Thank you, Rochelle. And Hannah, I saw that you put your comment. Do you want to have the floor just to also explain that? We have about a minute or so.
Sure. I was just going to note that more sweeping privacy legislation in the EU has enabled more transparency, as well as the right to say, I don't want my data shared anymore in this way with this entity, right? But that's more sweeping outside of just healthcare data. So there is some precedent for this here. I know more sweeping privacy legislation has been proposed here in the US in different venues, but would be interested, and maybe we can bring that back and ONC can update us on if there is any sort of proposal around this, because I think that might be relevant to also what we're discussing here as well.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you so much, Hannah. And thank you to the entire work group. We only have one more topic to go through during our next meeting. And then we are also going to prioritize all of the various different topics based off what we think has the greatest urgency for right now versus some additional time in order to think about potentially multi-pronged, multi-year approach. So once again, want to thank everyone for all of your inputs and perspectives. If there's any additional ideas, please feel free to email us as well as Michelle. We're happy to incorporate your various different thoughts. Our next meeting will actually be on the 26th of August, but we will present already the crosswalk ideas on this upcoming high-tech meeting. So once again, thank you, everyone. Enjoy the rest of your summer, and we look forward to seeing you all next week as well as our next meeting. The meeting is adjourned. Have a great day, everyone.
Hi, everyone.